This is how things came to pass. Rose was pregnant. His father told David as they ate chips by the Thames, boats bustling by and the smell of oil and seaweed mixing in the air. It was November 1939. There were more policemen on the streets than before, and men in uniform were everywhere. Sandbags were piled against the windows, and great lengths of barbed wire lay coiled around like vicious springs. Humpbacked Anderson shelters, dotted gardens, and trenches had been dug in parks. There seemed to be white posters on every available space, reminders of lighting restrictions, proclamations from the king, all of the instructions for a country at war. Most of the children David knew had by now left the city, thronging train stations with little brown luggage labels tied to their coats on their way to farms in strange towns. Their absence made the city appear emptier and increased the sense of nervous expectancy that seemed to govern the lives of all who remained. Soon the bombers would come, and the city was shrouded in darkness at night to make their task harder. The blackout made the city so dark it was possible to pick out the craters of the moon, and the heavens were crowded with stars, On their way to the river, they saw more barrage balloons being inflated in Hyde Park. When these were fully inflated, they would hang in the air anchored by heavy steel cables. The cables would prevent the German bombers from flying low, which meant that they would have to drop their payloads from a greater height. That way, the bombers would not be as certain of hitting their targets. The balloons were shaped like enormous bombs. David's father said it was ironic, and David asked him what he meant. His father said it was funny that something that was supposed to protect the city from bombs and bombers should look like a bomb itself. David nodded. He supposed it was strange. He thought of the men in the German bombers, the pilots trying to avoid the anti-aircraft fire from below, one man crouched over the bomb site while the city passed beneath him. He wondered if he ever thought of the people in the houses and the factories before he released the bombs. From high in the air, London would look just like a model with toy houses and miniature trees on tiny streets. Maybe that was the only way you could drop the bombs, by pretending that it wasn't real, that nobody would burn and die when they exploded below. David tried to imagine himself in a bomber, a British one, perhaps a Wellington or a Whitley, flying over a German city, bombs at the ready. Would he be able to release the load? It was a war, after all. The Germans were bad. Everybody knew that. They had started it. It was like a playground fight. If you started it, then you were to blame, and you couldn't really complain about what happened afterward. David thought that he would release the bombs, but he wouldn't think about the possibility that there might be people below. There would just be factories and shipyards, shapes in the darkness, and everyone employed in them would be safely tucked up in bed when the bombs fell and blew apart their places of work. A thought struck him. Dad, if the Germans can't aim properly because of the balloons, then their bombs could just drop anywhere, right? I mean, they'll be trying to hit factories, won't they? But they won't be able to, so they'll just let them go and hope for the best. They're not going to go home and come back another night just because of the balloons. David's father didn't reply for a moment or two. I don't think they care, he said at last. They want people to lose their spirit and their hope. If they blow up airplane factories or shipyards along the way, then so much the better. That's how a certain type of bully works. He softens you up before going in for the killer below. He sighed. We need to talk about something, David. Something important. They had just come from another session with Dr. Morbley, during which David was asked again if he missed his mother. Of course he missed her. It was a stupid question. He missed her, and he was sad because of it. He didn't need a doctor to tell him that. He had trouble understanding what Dr. Morbley was saying most of the time anyway, partly because the doctor used words that didn't understand, but mostly because his voice was now almost entirely drowned out by the dronings of the books on his shelves. The sounds made by the books had become clearer and clearer to David. He understood that Dr. Morley couldn't hear them the way he could, otherwise he couldn't have worked in his office without going mad. Sometimes, when Dr. Morbley asked a question of which the books approved, they would all say, In unison, like a male voice choir practicing a single note. If he said something of which they disapproved, they would mutter insults at him. Clown, charlatan, poppycock, the man's an idiot. One book, with the name Young graved on its cover in gold letters, grew so irate that it toppled itself from the shelf and lay on the carpet, fuming. Dr. Morbury looked quite surprised when it fell. David was tempted to tell him what the book was saying, but he didn't think it would be a very good idea to let Dr. Morbury know that he had heard books talking. David had heard of people being put away because they were wrong in the head. David didn't want to be put away. Anyway, he didn't hear the books talking all of the time now. It was only when he was upset or angry. David tried to stay calm, to think about good things as much as he could, but it was hard sometimes, especially when he was with Dr. Morbury or Rose. Now he was sitting by the river, and his whole world was about to change again. "You're going to have a little brother or sister," David's father said. "Rose is going to have a baby." David stopped eating his chips. They tasted wrong. He felt pressure building in his head, and for a moment he thought he might topple from the bench and suffer another of his attacks, but somehow he made himself stay upright. "Are you going to marry Rose?" he asked. "I expect so," said his father. David had heard Rose and his father discussing the subject the previous week when Rose had come to visit and David was supposed to be in bed. Instead, he sat on the chairs and listened to them talking. He did that sometimes, although he always went to bed when the talking ceased and he heard the smack of a kiss or Rose laughing in a low, throaty way. The last time he'd listened, Rose had spoken about people and how these people were talking. She didn't like what they were saying. That was when the subject of marriage came up, but David didn't hear any more of it because his father left the room to put the kettle on, and David only barely avoided being seen on the stairs. He thought his father might have suspected something because he came upstairs to check on David moments later. He kept his eyes closed and pretended to sleep, which seemed to satisfy his father, but David was too nervous to go back to the stairs again. "I just want you to know something, David," his father was saying to him. "I love you, and that will never change, no matter who else we share our life with. I loved your mom, too, and I'll always love her, but being with Rose has helped me a lot these last few months. She's a nice person, David. She likes you. Try to give her a chance, won't you?" David didn't reply. He swallowed hard. He had always wanted a brother or sister, but not like this. He wanted it to be with his mom and dad. This wasn't right. This wouldn't be really his brother or sister. It would come out of Rose, and it wouldn't be the same. His father placed his arm around David's shoulder. "Well, do you have anything to say?" he asked. "I'd like to go home now," said David. His father kept his arm around David for a second or two more, then let it drop. He seemed to sag slightly, as though someone had just let a little air out of him. "Fine," he said sadly. "Let's go home then." 6 months later, Rose gave birth to a little boy, and David and his father left the house in which David had grown up and went to live with Rose. And David's new half-brother, Georgie. Rose lived in a great big old house northwest of London, 3 stories high with large gardens at front and back and forests surrounding it. The house had been in her family for generations, according to David's father, and was at least 3 times as big as their own house. David had not wanted to move at first, but his father had gently explained the reasons to him. It was closer to his new place of work, and because of the war, he was going to have to spend more and more time there. If they lived closer to it, then he would be able to see David more often, and perhaps even come home for his lunch sometimes. His father also told David that the city was going to become more dangerous, and that out here they would be a little bit safer. The German planes were coming, and while David's father was sure that Hitler would be beaten in the end, things were going to get much worse before they got much better. David was not entirely sure what his father now did for a living. He knew that his dad was very good at math, and that he had been a teacher at a big university until recently. Then he had left the university and gone to work for the government in an old country house in the city. There were army barracks nearby, and soldiers manned the gates that led to the house and patrolled its grounds. Usually, when David asked his father about his work, he would just tell him that it involved checking figures for the government. But on the day that they finally moved from their house to Rose's, his father seemed to feel that David was owed something more. "I know that you like stories and books," his father said as they followed the moving van out of the city. "I suppose you wonder why I don't like them as much as you do." "Well, I do like stories in a way, and that's part of my job. You know how sometimes a story seems to be about one thing, but in fact it's about another thing entirely? There's a meaning hidden in it, and that meaning has to be teased out." "Like Bible stories," said David. On Sundays, the priest would often explain the Bible story that had just been read out loud. David didn't always listen because the priest was very dull indeed, but it was surprising that what the priest could see in stories that seemed quite simple to David. In fact, the priest appeared to like making them more complicated than they were, probably because it meant that he could talk for longer. David didn't care much for church. He was still angry at God for what had happened to his mother and for bringing Rose and Georgie into his life. "But some stories aren't meant to have their meaning understood by just anyone," David's father continued. "They're meant only for a handful of people, and so the meaning is very carefully hidden. It can be done using words or numbers or sometimes both together, but the purpose is the same. It's to prevent anyone else who sees it from interpreting it. Unless you know the code, it has no meaning." While the Germans use codes to send messages, so do we. Some of them are very complicated, and some of them appear very simple, although often those are the most complicated of all. Someone has to try to figure them out, and that's what I do. I try to understand the secret meanings of stories written by people who don't want me to understand them. He turned to David and laid a hand on his shoulder. "I'm trusting you with this," he said. You must never tell anyone else what it is that I do." He raised a finger to his lips. "Top secret, old chap." David imitated the gesture. "Top secret," he echoed. And they drove on. David's bedroom was at the very top of the house, in a little low room that Rose had chosen for him because it was filled with books and bookshelves. David's own books found themselves sharing the shelves with other books that were older or stranger than they were. He made space for his books as best as he could, eventually settling on ordering the books on the shelves according to size and color because they looked better that way. It meant his books kept getting mixed up with those that were already there, so one book of fairy tales ended up squeezed between a history of communism and an examination of the last battles of the First World War. David had tried to read a little of the book on communism, mainly because he wasn't entirely sure what communism was, apart from the fact that his father seemed to think it was something very bad indeed. He managed to get about 3 pages into it before he lost interest. Its talk of workers' ownership of the means of production, and the predation of capitalists amongst, almost put him to sleep. The history of the First World War was a little better, if only for the many drawings of old tanks that had been cut out of an illustrated magazine and stuck between various pages. There was also a dull textbook of French vocabulary and a book about the Roman Empire that had some very interesting drawings in it and seemed to take a lot of pleasure in describing the cruel things that the Romans did to people and that other people did to the Romans in return. David's book of Greek myths, meanwhile, was the same size and color as a collection of poetry nearby, and he would sometimes pull out the poems instead of the myths. Some of the poems weren't too bad once he gave them a chance. One was about a kind of knight, except in the poem he was called a child. And his search for a dark tower and whatever secret it contained. The poem didn't really seem to end properly, though. The knight reached a tower and, well, that was it. David wanted to know what was in the tower and what happened to the knight now that he reached it, but the poet obviously didn't think it was important. It made David wonder about the kinds of people who wrote poems, anyone who could see that the poem was really only getting interesting when the knight reached a tower, but that was the point at which the poet decided to go off and write something else instead. Perhaps he had meant to come back to it and had simply forgotten, or maybe he couldn't come up with a monster for the tower that was impressive enough. David had a vision of the poet surrounded by bits of paper, with lots of ideas for creatures crossed out or scribbled over. Werewolf. Dragon. Really big dragon. Witch. Really big witch. Small witch. David tried to give a form to the beast at the heart of the poem, but found that he could not. It was more difficult than it appeared, for nothing quite seemed to fit. Instead, he could only conjure up a half-formed being that crouched in the cobwebbed corners of his imagination, where all things that he feared curled and slithered upon one another into the darkness. In the darkness. David was aware of a change in the room as soon as he began to fill the empty spaces on the shelves, the newer books looking and sounding uneasy beside the others from the past. Their appearance was intimidating, and they spoke to David in dusty, rumbling tones. The older books were bound in calfskin and leather, and some of them contained knowledge that had long been forgotten, or that was found to be incorrect as science. And the process of discovery uncovered new truths. The books that held this old knowledge had never come to terms with this relegation of their worth. They were now lower than stories, for stories were intended at some level to be made up and untrue, but these other books had been born for greater things. Men and women had worked hard on their creation, filling them with a sum total of all that they knew and all that they believed about the world. That they were misguided and the assumptions they made were now largely worthless was almost impossible for the books to bear. A great book that claimed that the end of the world, based on a close examination of the Bible, would occur in 1783, had largely retreated into madness, refusing to believe that the present date was any later than 1782, for to do so would be to admit that its contents were wrong and that its existence, therefore, had no purpose beyond that of a mere curiosity. A slim work on the current civilizations of Mars, written by a man with a large telescope and an eye that discerned the paths of canals where no canals had ever flowed, gabbled constantly about how the Martians had retreated below the surface and were now building great engines in secret. It currently occupied a position amongst a number of books on sign language for the deaf, which fortunately could not hear anything that was being said to them. But David also discovered books that were similar to his own. There were thick, illustrated volumes of fairy stories and folk tales, the colors still rich and full within, and it was to these works that David turned his attention in those first days in his new home, lying on the window seat and staring down occasionally upon the forest beyond, as though expecting the wolves and witches and ogres from the stories suddenly to materialize below, for the descriptions in the books matched so accurately the woods bordering the house that it was almost impossible to believe they were not one and the same. An impression strengthened by the nature of the book's construction, for some of their stories had been added to by hand, and the drawings within had been carefully created by someone with no small talent for their art. David could find no name upon the books to identify the author of the additions, and some of the tales were unfamiliar to him while still retaining echoes of the tales he knew almost by heart. In one story, a princess was forced to dance all night and sleep all day by actions of a sorcerer, but instead of being rescued by the intervention of a prince or a clever servant, the princess died only for her ghost to return and torment the sorcerer to such a degree that he threw himself into a chasm in the earth and was burned to death in its fires. A little girl was threatened by a wolf while walking through the forest, and as she fled from him, she met a woodsman with an axe, but in this story, the woodsman did not merely kill the wolf and restore the girl to her family. Oh no. He cut the wolf's head off, then brought the girl to his cottage in the thickest, darkest part of the forest, and there he kept her until she was old enough to wed him, and she became his bride in a ceremony conducted by an owl, even though she had never stopped crying for her parents in all the years that he had kept her prisoner. And she had children by him, and the woodsmen raised to them to hunt wolves and to seek out people who strayed from the paths of the forest. They were told to kill the men and take what was valuable from their pockets, but to bring the woman to him. David read the stories by day and by night, his blankets drawn around him to protect him from the cold, for Rose's house was never warm. The wind found its way in through cracks in the window frames and the ill-fitting doors, rustling the pages of open books as though seeking within some piece of knowledge that it desperately required for its own purposes. The gray sweeps of ivy that covered the house front and back had broken through the walls over the decades, so that tendrils crept from the upper corners of David's room or bound themselves to the underside of the windowsill. At first, David had tried to cut them with the scissors, discarding the remnants, but after a few days the ivy would return, seemingly thicker and longer than before, clinging ever more tenaciously to the wood and the plaster. Insects exploited the holes too, so that the boundary between the natural world and the world of the house became blurred and unclear. He found beetles congregating in the closet and earwigs exploring his sock drawer. At night he heard mice scurrying behind the boards. It was as if nature was claiming David's room as its own. Worse, when he slept he dreamed more often of the creature he had named the Crooked Man, who walked through forests very like the one beyond David's window. The Crooked Man would advance to the edge of the tree line, staring out at an expanse of green lawn to where a house just like Rose's stood. He would speak to David in his dreams. His smile was mocking, and his words made no sense to David. "We are waiting," he would say. "Welcome, Your Majesty. All hail the new king."